Hello and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks. Today we're going to do two chapters from The Unabridged Version of the International Jew by Henry Ford, starting volume 2, 80 chapters total, written over about 91 weeks over a couple of years. Henry Ford charged his researchers at the Dearborn Independent with investigating Jews and finding out what was going on with them and why they were, in fact, the world's foremost problem. He collected all these articles that appeared in the Dearborn Independent, a newspaper, in a book of four volumes, 80 chapters, The International Jew. And it was probably the biggest publication ever in the history of the world up to that time dealing with the Jewish problem. And 95 years after that, as we come to you today, they are still a great problem. So let's get into Volume 2, and you can find everything that we do at vnnforum.com. We've done the first 20 chapters that make up Volume 1, and now we're starting this week on Volume 2, chapters 21 to 42. And in this segment, we're going to do two of them. 21, How Jews in the U.S. Conceal Their Strength, and secondly, Jewish Testimony on Are Jews a Nation? So let's get into it. Now, Chapter 21 begins with an epigraph from Leo N. Levi, president of B'nai B'rith, 1900 to 1904. And they would go on to found the ADL in about another 10 years after 1904. Leo Levi, or Levi, says, "The distinctive character of the Jew does not arise solely from his religion. It is true that his race and religion are indissolubly connected. But whatever be the cause of this junction of the race idea with the religion, it is very certain that the religion alone does not constitute the people. A believer in the Jewish faith does not by reason of that fact become a Jew. On the other hand, however, a Jew by birth remains a Jew, even though he abjures his religion, rejects it." And then the chapter itself properly begins. How the Jews in the U.S. conceal their strength. How many Jews are there in the United States? No Gentile knows. The figures are exclusive property of the Jewish authorities. The government of the United States can provide statistics on almost every matter pertaining to the population of the country, but whenever it is attempted in a systematic way to get information about the Jews who are constantly entering the country and the number now resident here, the Jewish lobby at Washington steps in and stops it. For more than 20 years, the fight for the right of the U.S. government to make a complete census of the people has been going on, and for the same period, the Jewish lobby at the Capitol has been strong enough to win. So strong enough in the 1900 to 1920 period, with Jews only coming to the U.S. in great numbers after 1880. And then you have this article being written in 1920 in the fall, and you have the 1924 Immigration Act that limited incomers or immigrants to their percentage of the stock already in the population in order to preserve the Northwestern racial character of the country, i.e. British Germanic. But the point is, basically from the time they arrived, Jews had tremendous political power in the U.S. It didn't take them much time at all to acquire it. And to the extent they didn't have power, it was purely because the mass media that they would come to dominate didn't exist yet, nor did a giant federal government. That only came in after the Jews had been here a couple decades and they were able to get the income tax passed, the IRS set up, the Federal Reserve set up. All this stuff happened in the 1910 to 1915 period. The formation of the ADL also in that period with pedophile rapist Leo Frank. ADL set up to make sure that no Jew would ever suffer justice again after raping and murdering a white girl. That was what the ADL was founded for. So all these bad things got their start in the first 20 years of from 1900 to 1920 as Jews really started feeling their strength in the U.S., feeling their oats, and taking over control, not just of the government, but of making the government, supersizing the government. The government was centralized as a result of the Civil War. It became essentially a federal dictatorship that the feds were not, rather than a confederation of independent states. But the federal government was still small. But it began to grow rapidly in the first half. It became 100 times bigger in the first half of 1900 to 1950 than it had ever been before from its founding in in the late 1700s. So Jews are taking advantage of the new modern technologies, the new ways to knit the nation physically and electronically, and they're growing the centralized government so that they can have maximum leverage from their numbers. And what their numbers are, we don't even know, because they keep that hidden from the government. They successfully lobby the government not to collect statistics on them like it does every other group, is what Ford is saying. The alarming increase in Jewish immigration at the present time has brought the question to public attention again. For the first time in the history of the U.S., a national conviction is forming upon this subject. From Europe came the first news which startled this country. The report told of vast mobilizations of Jewish people at stated rendezvous in Europe. Maybe rendezvous points. Great barracks were built for them. Large bodies of trained men went from the U.S. under orders of Jewish secret societies to expedite passport work, as it is termed among those bodies. Immigration into the United States became a business, a strictly Jewish business. Why is that statement made, a strictly Jewish business? For this reason. There are countries in Europe from which today no Gentile can be admitted to the United States. From Germany, from Russia, from Poland. It is with the utmost difficulty that even one person can be won permission to enter this country. But Jews from Poland, Germany, and Russia, by the thousands, come in most freely, in utter disregard of the laws, in open contempt of the health regulations, a strictly Jewish business of getting another million Jews into the United States. It is like moving an army, which, having done duty in Europe for the subjugation of that continent, is now being transferred to America. We think of the invasion of the body snatchers and the way that they move pods around from production centers to trucks. The pods would duplicate the people and take over. And that comes inevitably to mind if you've seen those horror movies. There's one in the 50s and a remake in 78 that's better, by Donald Sutherland. When the conditions overseas were made known in this country, and it became apparent that Jewish societies in the United States were the principal aids in this stampede to America, the newspapers, for the first time in American history, began to comment on a Jewish question in tones of alarm. This in itself is an indication that the facts are becoming too challenging to be longer ignored. Even the ordinary immigration officials, who for years have watched the human stream as it flowed over Ellis Island, have this year been startled into attention and action by the sharp change that has come in the character of the stream. And what startled them? First, it is composed almost entirely of Jews. Real Ukrainians, real Russians, real Germans cannot come in. But Jews can come in from anywhere, and are coming from almost everywhere. Why this special privilege, is being asked. Second, they do not come as refugees, as people fleeing from hunger and persecution. They come as if they own the country. They arrive as special guests. As on the other side, the passport business is arranged, so on this side, the entrance business is arranged. The laws are set aside. Health regulations are ignored. Why should they not behave as if they own the United States? They see officials of Jewish secret societies override officials of the United States Immigration Bureau. Their first glimpse of life here shows a Jewish control as potent and complete as it is in Russia. No wonder, then, that they literally beat down the walls and gates with all the éclat of a victorious invasion. Is not this America, the Jews' country, as it is called in the smaller nations of Europe? Third, there is a perfect organization which overcomes the numerous objections which arise against admission of known revolutionary Jews. European Jews are potential revolutionists. They are the revolutionists of Italy, Germany, Russia, and Poland today. They are the Red and IWW leaders of the United States today. When one man whose record is known presents himself at Ellis Island, and of course he is one in a thousand whose records are not known, he is held up. Immediately there start across the country telegrams to congressmen, editors, state and municipal officials, telling them in peremptory tones to get busy in behalf of Mr. So-and-so, who is detained at Ellis Island. And the same day there start back to Washington telegrams from congressmen, editors, and others of influence, insisting on the spotless character of Mr. So-and-so and demanding his immediate admittance into the United States. Sometimes also the Russian embassy, so-called, is used in this work. It is an invasion, nothing but an invasion, and it is helped by influences within the United States. It is thinly cloaked with sentiment. These people are fleeing from persecution. It is cleverly assisted by photographs showing groups of forlorn-looking women and children, never by photographs showing the groups of husky young revolutionists who are just as ready to despoil the United States as they were to despoil Russia. And the irony here is, as I read this in 2015, this exact thing is going on with the Jews fomented wars in the Middle East and then use the husky young revolutionists of Syria, Muslims, and ship millions of them into Germany. They're estimated there's going to be 1 to 2 to 3 million of them in the next 2 years by the end of 2016. This is how they destroy nations, take over nations, and then fill the nations with mud to destroy their racial character. That, however, is the present situation. What this and a subsequent article propose to do for the reader is to put him in possession of some of the facts concerning the government's fight on this question during the last century. The question is not peculiar to America, and it may throw a sidelight on the American phase to note some of the facts developed at the hearings of the British Royal Commission on Alien Immigration, which sat in London in 1902. A feature of whose proceedings was the testimony of Theodor Herzl, the great propagandist of Zionism. In his initial statement to the commission, Herzl made these statements, among others. The fact that there is now, for the first time since Cromwell, a perceptible number of our people in England, remember the Jews have been kicked out of England, and then they bribe Cromwell to let them back in, is the true cause of this commission being called together. That a serious pressure exists in England, the fact of your commission sitting is full proof. Then the examination proceeded until the following was brought out. The answers are Herzl's. Long block quote here. Question. Looking at the question of alien immigration from the standpoint of the United States for a moment, you have referred to the fact that America excludes. Answer. Yes. The exclusion is a partial exclusion. Answer. Exclusion, as I know, is worked in this way. The immigrant must show a certain amount of money at the moment of his landing. Question. You are aware that the stream of immigration into the United States is twice as much as the immigration into the United Kingdom. Answer, I know that. New York now has the greatest Jewish population of all the towns in the world. Question, and the actual exclusion is the actual exclusion of a small proportion. Answer, yes, but they go, however, to America. I think it is so easy to evade such a prohibition. For instance, if they joined a small company, it would lend the necessary amount to each immigrant, and the immigrant shows it and comes in and sends back by post the amount he has borrowed. There are no efficacious measures to prevent that. Talking about how they get around the law. Question. I took it that your reference to the United States was an approval of the action of that country as an act of self-preservation. Answer. No. A little later on in the examination, the question of immigration to the United States was again brought in. The answers are still Dr. Herzl's, and remember that the date is still 1902. Are you aware whether it is the fact or not that the leading Jews in America have informed their correspondents here that they cannot receive and distribute any more Jewish immigrants? Answer. I have heard of difficulties of emigration and that they are overcrowded with Jews. As to that information, I cannot say. Question. In your opinion, would not the stream of emigration to America have been much greater if no such law had existed? Answer. I think this law did not alter it much. The prohibition could not change it. Question. On what grounds do you believe that? Answer. It is a question of coasts and harbors. They come in. How will you prevent a man from coming in? Do you mean they are smuggled in? No, I do not believe that, but they always find a means to come in. Ford again. Now, discussion of immigration in the United States has never been free. We have talked a great deal about it in general terms, but not in terms of specific races except the Chinese and Japanese. However, Herzl seems to have known that wherever the Jews congregate in noticeable numbers, they become trouble. His words are, America, where so soon as they form a perceptible number, they become a trouble and a burden to the land. And he also knew that his efforts would be made to meet that condition, or that efforts would be made to meet that condition. But more than that, he dropped what must be construed as a warning, that such efforts would be resisted. He said, there exists a French proverb, cet animal est très impatient, il se défend quand on l'attaque. If the Jews are attacked, they will defend themselves, and you will get something like internal troubles. The time apparently did come in the U.S. when some far-seeing official began to wonder what the Jewish invasion portended. Already it was too strong to be openly attacked. The Jewish lobby at Washington was powerful even at that time, so apparently this official concluded that the best way to set about so momentous a task was to collect the information. But in order to get the information, Congress had to give its permission, and to get the permission of Congress, hearings had to be ordered. Hearings were ordered, and the records of them, though very scarce, still exist. The reader will be given important extracts from them presently, and he will see for himself how certain American statesmen reacted to the whole matter. A remark is in order here, namely, that the Jewish lobby eventually became more skillful. The key here is that Jews do not respect laws made by non-Jews. Therefore, for that reason alone, they cannot be part of any Goyish nation, because they simply follow their own rules. And I had a book written by Saul Bellow, a famous Jew novelist. It's something like Going to Jerusalem, and I haven't read it, but I just read the few opening pages, and he talks about Orthodox Jews on this plane to Jerusalem, along with himself, and the Goyish stewardesses are telling them, you know, the usual, put your tray tables up and your seats in the upright position, and they're just ignoring her, because they simply don't care. They don't notice, they don't pay any attention to what non-Jews say, because they're just stupid animals, and they do their own thing. And that informs every action that they take. So they cannot be in the same nation as whites. I mean, it can't be any simpler than this. Okay, as we say, so hearings were ordered, and the records of them, though very scarce, still exist. The reader will be given important extracts from them presently, and he will see for himself how certain American statesmen reacted to the whole matter. A remark is in order here, namely, that the Jewish lobby eventually became more skillful in such matters. It now takes very good care that no officials shall be appointed who shall make suggestions which shall precipitate congressional hearings on the Jewish matter. The time is coming, of course, when the whole Jewish question may be threshed out by the government of the United States, but it will not be because an official precipitated it. It will be because the people demanded it. Officials are now much too wary to meddle with this question. They know too well the consequences. During the war, many a secret trail of danger led into Jewish quarters, and the secret serviceman who loyally made his reports was often surprised to find himself lifted completely off that trail. Why? All Jewish trails in this country were powerfully protected by hidden influences during the war. That's an important statement. Always the Jews do things, but they conceal what they're doing. It's kept out of the media, and it just happens to the victim. He doesn't know. Well, the time came in the United States when it was obviously desirable to know what elements were comprising our population, whether we were an Anglo-Saxon nation, Semitic, Latin, or what. The situation was this, and was so stated by government officials at the time. In the late 80s, that's 1880s, and previously, it could be safely assumed that an immigrant from Ireland was Irish, an immigrant from Norway or Sweden was Scandinavian, an immigrant from Russia was Russian, an immigrant from Germany was German, and so on. But times changed. Previous to 1880, the entry on a man's record, born in Russia, indicated that he was a Russian. But, says a statement made by a government official with reference to the 10 years following 1880, so many Hebrews have come from that country to the United States that born in Russia has come in popular opinion to mean a Russian Jew. And then the same official goes on to show that during a 10-year period when 666,561 Jews came from Russia, there also came from Russia large numbers of Poles, Finns, Germans, and Lithuanians. Now, to make a census enumeration of these peoples under the heading Russian was plainly misleading, and not only misleading but valueless for census purposes. The racial identity would be lost, and our knowledge of the racial makeup of the nation very incomplete. Therefore, The census authorities asked Congress for permission to classify people by race as well as by country of birth. It seemed perfectly reasonable. Of what possible use is it to classify 3 million Jews as Russians when there are very few real Russians in the country and when the Russian and the Jew are so deeply different from one another? Senator Simon Guggenheim arose in the committee to object. He used the common formula in such cases. He said, "Personally, I object to it, not because I am a Hebrew, but because it is not in place." That is the common Jewish formula of objection. The B'nai B'rith says the same thing when it forces Shakespeare's Merchant of Venice out of the public schools. That society's anti-defamation circular always includes the thought, "We do not base our request on the embarrassment which may be caused to the Jewish students in the class, nor is our attitude in this regard based on thin-skinned sensitiveness. Our objection is made because of the effect upon the non-Jewish children, who subconsciously will associate in their minds the Jew, as Shakespeare portrayed him, with the Jew of today." So Senator Guggenheim, therefore, was playing the game according to the rules made and established in such cases. At this hearing, Senator La Follette was chairman. Senator Guggenheim's contention was that Jew was the name of a member of a religious denomination and not of a race. Chairman La Follette, "I can see broad ethnological reasons why sometime it would be important to know from what blood and race the man came." Senator Guggenheim, "Why not ask his religion?" Senators McCumber and Bailey came to the support of Senator Guggenheim's contention that Jew is a religious and not a racial term. Chairman La Follette, "I do not just get your objection to this, Senator Guggenheim. What objection can one have to having the race to which he belongs correctly entered?" Senator Guggenheim, "Because it is not correct when stated that way. The Jews are not a race." Later on in the hearing, Senator Cummins entered the discussion in response to a pro-Jewish remark made by Senator Bailey. Senator Bailey, "If I were a Hebrew and I had been born here and they wanted me to say I was anything but an American, I would have a difference with the enumerator. I would perhaps refuse to answer their questions." Senator Cummins, "I would not have any hesitancy in stating from what blood I was." Senator Bailey, "No, but in that case I refer to it, it would be a matter of religion." Senator Guggenheim, "That is the point. It is a question of religion." So they use their religion canard. The religion, it's religion not race, is a canard that they use to evade enumeration so that you don't not only don't know what you're up to, what they're up to, you don't know how many of them there are. That was in April 1909. In December 1909, Simon Wolfe was the chief witness for the pro-Jewish contention. Simon Wolfe is a very interesting character. From before the days of President Lincoln, he has been a lobbyist for the Jews at the National Capitol and has been in contact with every president from Lincoln to Wilson. At the hearing where Mr. Wolfe testified, Senator Dillingham acted as a chairman, and the whole proceeding was enlivened and clarified by the vigorous part which Senator Lodge took in it. Certain extracts, which entirely reproduce the spirit and argument of the hearing, follow. Mr. Wolfe, "The point we make is this. A Jew coming from Russia is a Russian, from Romania a Romanian, and from France a Frenchman, from England an Englishman, and from Germany a German. That Hebrew or Jewish is simply a religion." Senator Lodge, "Do I understand you to deny that the Jews are a race?" Mr. Wolfe, "How?" Senator Lodge, "Do you deny that the word Jew is used to express a race?" Mr. Wolfe, "As the representative of the Union of American Hebrew Congregations, which I have been for nearly 30 years, I took up the matter and propounded a series of interrogations to some of the leading Jews of the United States, among others, Dr. Cyrus Adler, who is a librarian of the Smithsonian, and every one of them states that the Jews are not a race." Senator Lodge, "That, I think, is an important point. I have always supposed they were. I find in the preface of the Jewish Encyclopedia, which is signed by Cyrus Adler, among others, this statement, quote, "An even more delicate problem that presented itself at the very outset was the attitude to be observed by the Encyclopedia in regard to those Jews who, while born within the Jewish community, have, for one reason or another, abandoned it. As the present work deals with the Jews as a race, it was found impossible to exclude those who were of that race, whatever their religious affiliations might have been. Karl Marx's family, for example, was baptized into some form of Protestantism, yet he remains a Jew, because Judaism is a race, but they're lying about it. In the same encyclopedia is a statement by Joseph Jacobs, B.A., formerly president of the Jewish Historical Society of England. Anthropologically considered, the Jews are a race of markedly uniform type, due either to unity of race or to similarity of environment. It's from Joseph Jacobs, formerly president of the Jewish Historical Society of England. Do you mean to deny, I want to understand your position, that the word Jew is a racial term? Mr. Wolf, I have made my statement and my opinions are in this pamphlet, lied the Jew. Senator Lodge, let me get at it. How would you classify Benjamin Disraeli? Was he a Jew? He was born a Jew. He was baptized as a Christian. He then ceased to be a Jew? Yes, he ceased to be a Jew. He's playing lawyer ball with the questions. Ah, religiously, says Senator Lodge from one of the oldest, more distinguished American families. He was very proud of the fact that he was a Jew and always spoke of himself in that way, and he wrote it in his novels also about the racial pride of the Sephardic Jews. Did the fact that he changed his religion alter his race? Mr. Wolf, it did not change the fact that he was born a Jew, not at all, and I know the Jewish people throughout the world have claimed him. Heine and Born and others who were born of their blood as being Jews when they speak of persons who have accomplished something wonderful in the world, but they cease to be Jews from the standpoint of religion. He's totally playing Jew ball, playing lawyer ball with the facts. He's being extremely disingenuous. Senator Lodge, undoubtedly, what I want to get at is whether the word Jew or Hebrew is not a correct racial term. Mr. Wolf, if you will pardon me, you will find a letter from Dr. Cyrus Adler right at the close of the pamphlet, which perhaps you might read for the benefit of the committee. Senator Lodge, after reading the letter referred to, I do not think that answers anything. And break, and then again, Senator Lodge, it never occurred to me until I heard you were coming here that the classification as made by the immigration authorities had anything to do with religion. I supposed it was race classification. A race classification. It is important, very important, to get the race classification as nearly as we can. And again, Mr. Wolf, you are aware that the Census Bureau some time ago attempted to classify in the same manner and it was prohibited from doing so. Senator Lodge, the word race was stricken out of the census bill. I think it was a great mistake. It makes the returns almost valueless. Mr. Wolf, I can simply repeat what I have said, that I am voicing the opinions of those whom I represent, the Union of American Hebrew Congregations and the Order of B'nai B'rith. They are opposed to the classification as made in the last few years and as complicated, so far as I am informed, in the report of the commission. So here we have when America was still not completely controlled by Jews, and you have a sort of open back and forth between a representative of Zog as it was coming to exist and the old white America and Lodge and Wolf doing battle here. And the Jews were at that time, say they're roughly equal in power to the whites, or they were about 40% and the whites were about 60%, and soon they would pass. But under FDR, another 10, 12 years later, they would pass the whites. But at this point, whites were a little stronger. They were perhaps a little complacent. They didn't fully appreciate the scope and the danger of the problem they faced. It was kind of a dark background force, but they were aware of its growing power, and I've alluded many times. It's in the novels of F. Scott Fitzgerald, this idea of the Jews as coming in and looking around and seizing powers, glittery eyes and sleek and fast-moving, selling, moving up socially and passing the wasp, degraded multimillionaires, complacent. And so the Jews did not get their way in 1924. They nearly did. But they soon took basically complete control of the U.S., not that long after in the 30s, I think it would be fair to say. Or at least they became they moved past the 50% level, at least in the 30s, and maybe they acquired complete institutional control by, say, 1970, I think we could say. The hearings continued. Julian W. Mack, later appearing for the Jewish contention. From the extracts given in this article, four matters become very clear. First, the Jew is opposed to any restrictive legislation against his entrance into a country. Second, the Jew is opposed to any racial classification of himself after he has entered a country. Third, the Jewish argument to the Gentile authorities is that the Jew represents a religion and not a race. Fourth, that at least one indication has appeared in which the Jew has one view to present to the Gentiles and another which he cherishes among his own people on this question of race. Another point might be made as this, when the authorities' disregard is untenable, the argument of religion, not race, the Jewish spokesmen fall back on the fact that their organizations don't want certain things and won't have certain things, argument or no argument, commission or no commission. The Jewish lobbyists have had their way. There is no enumeration of Jews in the United States. There are 46 other classifications, but none for the Jew. The Northern Italians are distinguished in the records from the Southern Italians. The Moravians are distinguished from the Bohemians. The Scotch from the English. The Spanish American from the Spanish European. The West Indians from the Mexicans. But the Jew is not distinguished at all. None of the other races made an objection. On this point, the report of the commission reads, as far as ascertained by the commission, the practice of classifying the foreign-born by race or people rather than by country of birth is acceptable to the people of the United States, with one exception. The officials, who were endeavoring to have the census report show with scientific accuracy the actual racial components of the population of the United States, were compelled to see their recommendation eliminated. What is the result? If you ask the government of the United States how many Frenchmen there are in the country, it can give you the figures. If you ask for the number of Poles, it is there. If you ask for the number of Africans, it is known. On down a long list, you may make your inquiries, and you will find that the government knows. But ask the government of the United States how many Jews are in the country, and it cannot tell. There are no records. If you want information upon that point, you will have to go to the officials or representatives of the Jewish government in the United States. Of course, if a Jew is a religious term like Baptist, Catholic, Christian, Scientist, or Quaker, then there is merit in the argument that religious questions are not proper for the government to ask, unless the religion comes in conflict with or is a menace to the ideals of the Republic. But if Jew is a racial term or national term, then the government is properly interested in making a record of all the inhabitants of this land who bear it. Like all questions pertaining to the Jews, this can be settled by their own words. What the Jews teach Jews in this matter should be the determining point. In the next article, we shall see what Jews themselves have to say about race or religion. And that ends the article. Now, that was published 9 October 1920, so we'll move on to the next, chapter 22, Jewish Testimony on Our Jews a Nation. So they're basically up there in Congress lying that they're a religion, not a race, even while, which is typical of their chutzpah, which they pride themselves on, which is their culture, being brazen liars. They know they're a race. They tell their kids they're a race, as we're about to hear in chapter 22. But when they go before the Goyim, they must insist that they're a religion, and they don't want to be counted. They don't want anyone to know what they're up to. They don't even want people to know how many of them there are. If cockroaches could talk, they would say the same kind of things that Jews do. And so, chapter 22, Jewish Testimony on Are Jews a Nation? Begins with a couple of quotes, although not epigraphs. I will give you my definition of a nation, and you can add the adjective Jewish. A nation is, in my mind, an historical group of men of a recognizable cohesion held together by a common enemy. Then, if you add to that word Jewish, if you add to that the word Jewish, you have what I understand to be the Jewish nation. Theodor Herzl, that's the founder of Zionism. And another quote from Louis D. Brandeis, Justice of the United States Supreme Court, and I believe he became Chief Justice under FDR. Let us all recognize that we Jews are a distinct nationality of which every Jew, whatever his country, his station, or shade of belief, is necessarily a member. So Brandeis confirms Jews are a nationality. And Herzl says it's people with a common enemy. That's very interesting. This article is designed to put the reader in possession of information regarding the Jew's own thoughts of himself as regards race, religion, and citizenship. In the last article, we saw the thought which Jewish representatives wish to plant in Gentile minds concerning this matter. The Senate committee, which was to be convinced, was made up of Gentiles. The witnesses who were to do the convincing were Jews. Senator Simon Guggenheim said, "There is no such thing as a Jewish race because it is the Jewish religion." Simon Wolf said, "The point we make is this, that Hebrew or Jewish is simply a religion." Julian W. Max said, "Of what possible value is it to anybody to classify them as Jews simply because they adhere to the Jewish religion?" The object of this testimony was to have the Jews classified under various national names, such as Polish, English, German, Russian, or whatever it might be. Now, when the inquirer turns to the authoritative Jewish spokesman who speak not to Gentiles but to Jews about this matter, he finds an entirely different kind of testimony. Some of this testimony will now be presented. So it's the old dual code. They say one thing to the Goyim. British in public, Yiddish in private. You show one face to the Goyim. They show another face among themselves. And they really are like that, if you've ever known them. The reader will bear in mind that, as the series is not written for entertainment, but for instruction in the facts of a very vital question, the present article will be of value only to those who desire to know for themselves what are the basic elements of the matter. It should also be observed during the reading of the following testimony that sometimes the term race is used, sometimes the term nation. In every case, it is recognized that the Jew is a member of a separate people, quite aside from the consideration of his religion. First, let us consider the testimony which forbids us to consider the term Jew as merely the name of a member of a religious body only. Louis Brandeis, Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States and world leader of the Zionist movement, says, this is a quote from Louis Brandeis, appointed to the Supreme Court. "Councils of rabbis and others have undertaken at times to prescribe by definition that only those shall be deemed Jews who professedly adhere to the Orthodox or Reform faith. But in the connection in which we are considering the term, it is not in the power of any single body of Jews, or indeed of all Jews collectively, to establish the effective definition. The meaning of the word Jewish in the term Jewish problem must be accepted as coextensive with the disabilities which it is our problem to remove. Those disabilities extend substantially to all of Jewish blood. The disabilities do not end with the renunciation of faith, however sincere. Despite the meditations of pundits or decrees of councils, our own instincts and acts, and those of others, have defined for us the term Jew." That's from Zionism and the American Jews. The Reverend Mr. Morris Joseph, he's saying, whether or not you're a Jew, you believe or not, whatever you believe, we tend to think and act the same, and we get treated the same, the same disabilities. They're persecuted for being Jews. The Reverend Mr. Morris Joseph, West London Synagogue of British Jews, quote, "Israel is assuredly a great nation. The very word Israel proves it. No mere sect or religious community could appropriately bear such a name. Israel is recognized as a nation by those who see it. No one can possibly mistake it for a mere sect. To deny Jewish nationality, you must deny the existence of the Jew." Israel a nation is what that's from. To deny Jewish nationality, you must deny the existence of the Jew. Arthur D. Lewis, West London Zionist Association, quote, "When some Jews say they consider the Jews a religious sect, like the Roman Catholics or Protestants, they are usually not correctly analyzing and describing their own feelings and attitude. If a Jew is baptized, or what is not necessarily the same thing, sincerely converted to Christianity, few people think of him as no longer being a Jew. His blood, temperament, and spiritual peculiarities are unaltered." So that is the Jewish view, contrary to the Christian view, which is that if you sprinkle some water on the Jew's head, it somehow miraculously turns into a Christian. But the Jew says, the Jew is a race, and nothing changes if he's baptized or sincerely converts. He's still a Jew, racially. Bertram B. Benas, B-E-N-A-S, barrister at law, quote, the Jewish entity is essentially the entity of a people. Israelites, Jews, Hebrews, all the terms used to denote the Jewish people bear a specifically historical meaning, and none of these terms has been convincingly superseded by one of purely sectarian nature. The external world has never completely subscribed to the view that the Jewish people constitute merely an ecclesiastical denomination. It's from Zionism, the National Jewish Movement. Leon Simon, a brilliant and impressive Jewish scholar and writer, makes an important study of the question of religion and nationality in his volume, Studies in Jewish Nationalism. He makes out a case for the proposition that the religion of the Jews is nationalism, and that nationalism is an integral part of their religion. It is often said, indeed, that Judaism has no dogmas. The statement is not true as it stands. He then states some of the dogmas and continues. Quote, and the Messianic Age means for the Jew not merely the establishment of peace on earth and goodwill to men, but the universal recognition of the Jew and his God. It is another assertion of the eternity of the nation. Dogmas such as these are not simply the articles of faith of a church to which anybody may gain admittance by accepting them. They are the beliefs of a nation about its own past and its own future. Quote, for Judaism has no message of salvation for the individual soul, as Christianity has. All its ideas are bound up with the existence of the Jewish nation. And you see how perfectly positioned the Jews are by having Christianity turn the rest of the world into a bunch of individuals worried about their goofy little souls, while the Jews are bound up in protecting and advancing their own race, which pays them incredible dividends on earth, while the silly Christians are worried about an afterlife that doesn't even exist. It's ridiculous. Whites need their own racial nationalist religion equivalent. You don't have to call it a religion, but they need something like what the Jews have in order to take them on. The Jews have a customized product, a handcrafted, tailored pair of shoes, and the whites have a cheap, shabby, off-the-rack suit. You see, something that's custom tailored is better than something that's Catholic or general. The idea that the Jews are a religious sect, precisely parallel to Catholics and Protestants, is nonsense. Graetz, Heinrich Graetz, G-R-A-E-T-Z, it would be pronounced Graetz in German, the great historian of the Jews, whose monumental work is one of the standard authorities, says that the history of the Jews, ever since they lost the Jewish state, quote, still possesses a national character. It is by no means merely a creed or church history. Our history is far from being a mere chronicle of literary events or church history. Moses Hess, one of the historic figures through whom the whole Jewish program has flowed down from its ancient sources to its modern agents, wrote a book entitled Rome and Jerusalem, in which he stated the whole matter with clearness and force. Jewish religion, he says, is above all Jewish patriotism. So Judaism is nationalism. Judaism is patriotism. Judaism is not about the individual soul and its salvation, but rather about the group and its perpetuity. Were the Jews only followers of a certain religious denomination like the others, then it were really inconceivable that Europe, and especially Germany, where the Jews have participated in every cultural activity, should spare the followers of the Israelitish confession neither pains nor tears nor bitterness. The solution of the problem, however, consists in the fact that the Jews are something more than mere followers of a religion, namely they are a race brotherhood, a nation, a la B'nai B'rith. Hess, like every other authoritative Jewish spokesman, denies that forsaking the faith constitutes a Jew, a non-Jew. So you don't become a non-Jew. You can't. It's like saying you become non-white. Judaism has never excluded anyone. The apostates severed themselves from the bond of Jewry, And not even them has Judaism forsaken, added a learned rabbi in whose presence I expressed the above-quoted opinion. In reality, Judaism as a nationality has a natural basis which cannot be set aside by mere conversion to another faith, as is the case with other religions. A Jew belongs to his race, and consequently also to Judaism, in spite of the fact that he or his ancestors have become apostates. Every Jew is, whether he wishes it or not, solidly united with the entire nation. Simply to indicate that we have not been quoting outward opinions, but the actual beliefs of the most active and influential part of Jewry, we close this section of the testimony with excerpts from a work published in 1920 by the Zionist Organization of America from the pen of Jesse E. Sampter, S-A-M-P-T-E-R, quote, "The name of their national religion, Judaism, is derived from their national designation. An unreligious Jew is still a Jew, and he can with difficulty escape his allegiance only by repudiating the name of Jew." From the Guide to Zionism, page 5. It will be seen that none of these writers, and their number might be multiplied among both ancients and moderns, can deny that the Jew is exclusively a member of a religion, without at the same time asserting that he is, whether he will or not, the member of a nation. Some go so far as to insist that his allegiance is racial in addition to being national. The term race is used by important Jewish scholars without reserve, while some, who hold the German-originated view that Jews are an offshoot of the Semitic race and do not comprise that race, are satisfied with the term nation. Biblically, in both the Old Testament and the New, the term nation or people is employed. But the consensus of Jewish opinion is this: the Jews are a separate people, marked off from other races by the very distinctive characteristics, both physical and spiritual, and they have both a national history and a national aspiration. It will be noticed how the testimony on the point of race combines the thought of race and nationality, just as the previous section combined the thought of nationality with religion. Supreme Justice Brandeis, previously quoted, appears to give a racial basis to the fact of nationality. He says, "It is no answer to this evidence of nationality to declare that the Jews are not an absolutely pure race. There has, of course, been some intermixture of foreign blood in the 3,000 years which constitute our historic period. But owing to persecution and prejudice, the intermarriages with non-Jews which have occurred have resulted merely in taking away many from the Jewish community. Intermarriage has brought few additions. Therefore, the percentage of foreign blood in the Jews of today is very low. Probably no important European race is as pure," and that's more or less what Disraeli said in his novels, "but common race is only one of the elements which determine nationality." Arthur D. Lewis, a Jewish writer in his The Jews a Nation, also bases nationality on the racial element. Quote, "The Jews were originally a nation, and have retained more than most nations one of the elements of nationality, namely the race element. This may be proved, of course, by the commonest sense test of their distinguishability. You can more easily see that a Jew is a Jew than that an Englishman is an Englishman." And that's a good point. Moses Hess is also quite clear on this point. He writes of the impossibility of Jews denying their racial descent and says, "Jewish noses cannot be reformed, and the black, wavy hair of the Jews will not turn through conversion into blonde, nor can its curves be straightened out by constant combing. The Jewish race is one of the primary races of mankind that has retained its integrity in spite of the continual changes of its climactic environment, and the Jewish type has conserved its purity through the centuries." Jesse E. Sampter in The Guide to Zionism, recounting the history of the work done for Zionism in the United States, says, quote, "And this burden was nobly borne, due partly to the commanding leadership of such men as Justice Louis D. Brandeis, Judge Julian W. Mack, and Rabbi Stephen S. Wise, partly to the devoted and huge labors of the old-time faithful Zionists on the committee, such as Jacob de Haas, Louis Lipsky, and Henrietta Zold, and partly to the aroused race consciousness of the mass of American Jews." So everywhere in their literature that they're writing about themselves or for themselves, do they refer to themselves as a people, a nation, a race, a separate and apart, different, kept their racial purity, easier to identify a Jew than an Englishman. 4 times in the brief preface to the 5th edition of Coningsby, and that's one of the novels I mentioned earlier, or alluded to, Disraeli uses the term race in referring to the Jews, and Disraeli was proud of being racially a Jew, though religiously he was a Christian. In the Jewish Encyclopedia, the Jewish race is spoken of. In the preface, which is signed by Dr. Cyrus Adler as chief editor, these words occur, quote, "An even more delicate problem that presented itself at the very outset was the attitude to be observed by the encyclopedia in regard to those Jews who, while born within the Jewish community, have, for one reason or another, abandoned it. As the present work deals with the Jews as a race, it was found impossible to exclude those who were of that race, whatever their religious affiliations might have been." But as we are not interested in ethnology, says Ford, the inquiry need not be contained further along this line. The point toward which all this trends is that the Jew is conscious of himself as being more than the member of a religious body. That is, Jewry nowhere subscribes in the persons of its greatest teachers and its most authoritative representatives to the theory that a Jew is only, quote, "a brother of the faith." Often he is not of the faith at all, but he is still a Jew. The fact is insisted upon here not to discredit him, but to expose the double minds of those political leaders who, instead of straightforwardly meeting the Jewish question, endeavor to turn all inquiry aside by an impressive confusion of the Gentile mind. It may be argued by the small body of so-called Reform Jews that the authorities quoted here are mostly Zionists. The reply is there may be, and quite possibly are, 2 Jewish programs in the world, one which it is intended the Gentiles should see, and one which is exclusively for the Jews. In determining which is the real program, it is a safe course to adopt the one that is made to succeed. It is the program sponsored by the so-called Zionist which is succeeding. It was made to succeed through the Allied governments, through the peace conference, and now through the League of Nations. That, then, must be the true Jewish program, because it is hardly possible that the Gentile governments could have been led as they are being led were they not engaged that they are obeying the behests of the real princes of the Jews. It is all well enough to engage the plain Gentile people with one set of interesting things. The real thing is the one that has been put over, and that is the program whose sponsors also stand for the racial and national separateness of the Jews. The idea that the Jews comprise a nation is the most common idea of all among the Jews. Not only a nation with a past, but a nation with a future. More than that, not only as a nation, but as a supernation. We can go still further on the authority of Jewish statements. We can say that the future form of the Jewish nation will be a kingdom. And as to the present problems of the Jewish nation, there is plenty of Jewish testimony to the fact that the influence of American life is harmful to Jewish life. That is, they are in antagonism, like two opposite ideas. This point, however, must await development in the succeeding article. Israel Friedlander traces the racial and national exclusiveness of the Jews from the earliest times, giving as illustrations 2 biblical incidents. The Samaritans, who were half-Jews by race and who were eager to become full Jews by religion, and their repulse by the Jews, who were eager to safeguard the racial integrity of the Jews. Also, the demand for genealogical records and for the dissolution of mixed marriages as recorded in the book of Ezra. Dr. Friedlander says that in post-biblical times, this racial exclusiveness of the Jews became even more accentuated. Entry into Judaism never was, as in the other religious communities, purely a question of faith. Proselytes were seldom solicited, and even when ultimately admitted into the Jewish fold, they were so on the express condition that they surrender their racial individuality. For the purposes of the present inquiry, says Dr. Friedlander, it is enough for us to know that the Jews have always felt themselves as a separate race, sharply marked off from the rest of mankind. Anyone who denies the racial conception of Judaism on the part of the Jews in the past is either ignorant of the facts of Jewish history or intentionally misrepresents them. Elkin N. Adler says, "No serious politician today doubts that our people have a political future. This future of political definiteness and power was in the mind of Moses Hess when he wrote in 1862, mark the date, in the preface of his Rome and Jerusalem, these words, quote, "No nation can be indifferent to the fact that, in the coming European struggle for liberty, it may have another people as its friend or foe." Hess had just been complaining of the inequalities visited upon the Jews. He was saying that what the individual Jew could not get because he was a Jew, the Jewish nation would be able to get because it would be a nation. Evidently, he expected that nationhood might arrive before the, quote, "coming European struggle," and he was warning the Gentile nations to be careful, because in that coming struggle there might be another nation in the list, namely the Jewish nation, which could be either friend or foe to any nation it chose. Dr. J. Abelson, A-B-E-L-S-O-N, of Portsea College, P-O-R-T-S-E-A, in discussing the status of small nations as a result of the Great War, says, "The Jew is one of these smaller nations, and claims for the Jew what is claimed for the Pole, the Romanian, and the Serbian, and on the same ground, that of nationality." Judge Brandeis voices the same thought. He says, "While every other people is striving for the development by asserting its nationality, and a great war is making clear the value of small nations, let us make clear to the world that we too are a nationality clamoring for equal rights." Again, says Justice Brandeis, quote, "Let us all recognize that we Jews are a distinct nationality of which every Jew, whatever his country, his station, or shade of belief, is necessarily a member." And he concludes his article, from which these quotations are made, with these words, "Organize, organize, organize, until every Jew must stand up and be counted, counted with us, or prove himself, wittingly or unwittingly, of the few who are against their own people." And what a great statement that is. It shows you the value, the importance the Jews place on organization. It's absolutely essential in order to attain group goals. Organize. Sir Samuel Montague, the British Jew who has been appointed governor of Palestine under the British mandate, habitually speaks of the Jewish kingdom, usually employing the expression, "the restoration of the Jewish kingdom." It may be of significance that the native population already referred to Sir Samuel as, quote, "the king of the Jews." Aked Ha'am, A-C-H-A-D, and then a last name, H-A slash small H-A hyphen A-M. Aked Ha'am, who must be regarded as the one who has most conclusively stated the Jewish idea, capital J, capital I, as it has always existed, and whose influence is not as obscure as his lack of fame among the Gentiles might indicate, is strong for the separate identity of the Jews as a supernation. Leon Simon succinctly states the great teacher's views when he says, "While Hebraic thought is familiar with the conception of a superman, distinguished, of course, from Nietzsche's conception by having a very different standard of excellence, yet its most familiar and characteristic application of that conception is not to the individual, but to the nation, to Israel as the supernation or chosen people. In fact, the Jewish nation is presupposed in all characteristically Jewish thinking, just as it is presupposed in the teaching of the prophets. In those countries," says Moses Hess, "which form a dividing line between the Occident and the Orient, namely Russia, Poland, Prussia, and Austria, there live millions of our brethren who earnestly believe in the restoration of the Jewish kingdom and pray for it fervently in their daily services." So that's how they think of things. We're a nation, we're a people, we have a political future. We are a supernation. We're going to restore our kingdom. We pray for it. This article, therefore, at the risk of appearing tedious, has sought to summon from many sides and from many periods the testimony which should be taken whenever the subject of Jewish nationalism comes under discussion. Regardless of what may be said to Gentile authorities for the purpose of hindering or modifying their action, there can be no question as to what the Jew thinks of himself. The Jew absolutely 100% thinks of himself as belonging to a people, a nation, and a race, and one with a future. He thinks of himself as belonging to a people, united to that people by ties of blood, which no amount of creedal change can weaken. Heir of that people's past, agent of that people's political future. He belongs to a race. He belongs to a nation. He seeks a kingdom to come on this earth, a kingdom which shall be over all kingdoms, with Jerusalem the ruling center of the world, this ruling city of the world. That desire of the Jewish nation may be fulfilled. It is the contention of these articles that it will not come by way of the program of the protocols, nor by any of the other devious ways through which powerful Jews have chosen to work. The charge of religious prejudice has always touched the people of civilized countries in a tender spot. Sensing this, the Jewish spokesmen chosen to deal with non-Jews have emphasized the point of religious prejudice. It is therefore a relief to tender and uninstructed minds to learn that Jewish spokesmen themselves have said that the troubles of the Jew have never arisen out of his religion. The Jew is not questioned on account of his religion, but on account of other things which his religion ought to modify. Gentiles know the truth that the Jew is not persecuted on account of his religion. All honest investigators know it. The attempt to shield the Jews under cover of their religion is, therefore, in the face of the facts and of their own statements, an unworthy one. If there were no other evidence, the very evidence which many Jewish writers cite, namely the instant siding of the Jews with one another on any and every occasion, would constitute every evidence of racial and national solidarity. Whenever these articles have touched the international Jew financier, hundreds of Jews in the lower walks of life have protested. Touch a Rothschild, and the revolutionary Jew from the ghetto utters his protest and accepts the remark as a personal affront to himself. Touch a regular old-line Jewish politician, who is using a government office exclusively for the benefit of his fellow Jews as against the best interests of the nation, and the socialist and anti-government Jew comes out in his defense. Most of these Jews, it may be said, have lost a vital touch with the teachings and ceremonials of their religion, but they indicate what their real religion is by their national solidarity. This in itself would be interesting, but it becomes important in view of another fact, with which the next article will deal, namely the relation between this Jewish nationalism and the nationalism of the peoples among whom the Jew dwells. Or among whom the Jews dwell. So this again was that's the end of it. That's the 16th of October. So those are the two articles we've just done. Chapter 21 and 22 appeared in October of 1920. Weekly installments. So you see that the Jew does see himself as a member of a nation, but that in order to fool the Goyim, he pretends that it's merely a matter of religion. So don't be fooled. Which is the point of the Learning College, after all, to teach you things that you need to know to see your life in the true white context, stuff that you will not get in any accredited college or from any of the controlled media, controlled by the same Jews we're talking about. Anyway, thanks for being with me today, and I'll be back with you again real soon.